Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It is August 30th, and I didn't look at the schedule to see when your first test is, but it's coming sometime. It's next week, Thursday, thank you. Yeah, I believe that's correct. And don't forget, Monday is a holiday. This class doesn't meet on Mondays, but you probably have a class somewhere that meets on a Monday, and it won't meet on this coming Monday. So we do have a test on Thursday. You want to see where that chem flash quiz is, because you want to get a picture in your mind of what some of these chemicals are, right? And maybe we'll have time to practice that after lecture, but chances are we won't. So this is where you can find it. Dr minus J minus Gober. All right, control enter. We'll take you to there. And here's the chem flash quiz right here. Okay, you can right click, save it. You can bookmark it, all that kind of stuff. Save link as, or save target as, downloads it to your computer. It's either an AVI or a WMV, it might be an MPEG file, and then you can open it up in your preferred plugin for looking at videos. And which one did I recommend in here? Did I recommend any to you? You have RealPlayer, Windows Media Player, although sometimes you get the audio file playing, but not the video part, that's no good. Sometimes you get the video, but not the audio. But there's one plugin that has always worked and combined them together properly, and that's the DIVX, D-I-V-X. And there's a link in Blackboard for downloading that DIVX player. And that works for HD videos. It's a very powerful program, doesn't take a lot of computer resources. And I think it's so powerful you can play like 20 HD videos at one time if you want. It's pretty nice. So you should just be familiar with that kind of cool stuff anyway. Okay, one thing I did notice that was a little funny in Blackboard, I don't want to demonstrate to you, I can't undo the way Blackboard works, so there's nothing I can do to program it to work properly, but you know, every weekly module has some pages to it that you can click by going to page one and then hit the arrow, go to page two, hit the arrow, go to page three, or on the left there's a navigation frame and you can click what page you want to go to within a weekly module for Blackboard. All right, and then at the very bottom that has a dollar sign is your weekly online quiz. And if you go, say, the quiz is on the sixth page, if you hit the arrow to go from page five to page six, or if you hit the navigation button on the other and the left-hand frame to go directly to the quiz, what happens is, and this is a new feature in Blackboard, it opens up the quiz automatically in a new window. Right, and I wish I could stop that from happening, because I would actually like you to read the instructions on taking the quiz, which is in the page of the weekly assignment, and then after you read the instructions, then you can click the click to launch button, and then that automatically starts the quiz. All right, so that's just a little hassle that the quiz automatically opens up. But if it does automatically open up for you, just hit the X button and close that window. It doesn't really matter. All right, as long as you don't hit begin, just don't hit the begin button. And when you close that window, then you can see all the nice instructions on what's regarding the quiz. All right, and then when you're ready to take it, hit click to launch, and then it will take you to that window that was open, and then say begin, and you can take the quiz or not take the quiz or answer part of the quiz, because remember, it's unlimited number of times. As long as when you're done messing around in there, even if you just answer one question or no questions, always hit the save and submit button. And then that will allow you to go back in. There were a handful of students that maybe X'd out of the quiz or something. I'm not quite sure exactly what happened, but that kind of prevented you from going back in and taking the quiz again. And what it did is put a little paper symbol in your grade book. So then I just have to go in there and manually clear that if it happens. But one of the nice things about a computer is that it should be set up so it's all automated, so that I don't have to go back in and clear 100 quizzes that somehow got missubmitted at the wrong time or whatever, right? So always hit save and submit when you're done with the quiz, whether it's completed or not, right? Because you're going to go back and then finish the quiz, and it will always store your highest grade. So it really doesn't matter. So that would help me out just a tiny little bit. All right, sorry we got started so late. We were looking at some pH equations. Some students had some questions and talking about other things, about physiology, and I got carried away, lost track of time. Okay, so if you come see me during my office hours, always pay attention to your watch and say, hey, we got to go to class. Okay? because not all of you will fit outside my office if we want a whole class up there anyway. All right, so what the heck are we doing here? I think we move on to chapter 6 today. Okay, chapter 6. Is that right? How am I doing? Chapter 6? I think that's right. Lecture PowerPoints, here we are. Okay, then chapter 6, right here. All right, and then I'm going to turn around and look and see if this really is being projected on the screen. And it is. Maybe I'm going to turn some of these lights down just a little bit. I'm going to turn these off altogether. And I think that's as good as we can do in here, because if I do that, then you can't see your notes. All right, so chapter 6. This is kind of like physical chemistry. This is one of the coolest chapters in the book. All right, well, first we're going to look at the extracellular environment and then talk about how cells communicate with each other and how do they move things across membranes, things of that nature. So we're going to be talking about transport processes, things namely like diffusion and osmosis. And it's just a way that molecules can move around. And in order for a molecule to move around, it's got to be in the right kind of environment in the sense that it can't be a solid, right? So if we have a molecule in the center of this tabletop right here, and let's just say, you know, it's maybe plastic or marble or whatever it is, right? If it's in the center of this tabletop, it's not getting out anytime soon. It's stuck there, right? It's stuck in the lattice of this hard material. So if it's a solid, molecules really can't move around. But if the substance that a molecule is in is gas, then it can move around through this gaseous mixture very easily. Or if it's in a fluid, it can move through the fluid. So molecules can move around inside a fluid and through a gas. All right, so that's what this slide kind of tells us, is that our body is mostly made out of what? Is it mostly solid material or bone, or is it mostly fluid? It's mostly fluid, and indeed, okay, water makes up about 67% of your body, right? Oh, no, it's even more than that. It's 98, I think. But the amount of water inside cells, okay, the intracellular compartment is 67% of all the water that's in your body. So most of the water is inside cells, and that's handy for cells because things can move around inside of a cell because it's a water environment. Things can get to cells because on the outside of cells, it's mostly a water environment as well. All right, so there's two basic compartments that we're going to look at. First, there is the intracellular compartment, right? That's mostly water inside cells. An extracellular compartment is where? Is everything outside your cells, right? That's the extracellular compartment. All right, furthermore, we want to break this extracellular compartment. Oh, I see why I have a little confusion, because I can't find my arrow. Here it is. Sorry, let me do this. Okay. Now I'm happy. All right, so the extracellular compartment, right, 33% is outside of cells of all the water that's inside your body, but we want to break this extracellular compartment into two main regions, right? Part of that water is going to be found in blood plasma. Right, so most of 20% is in plasma, which is the fluid part of blood, right? And the other remaining 80% is in interstitial fluid. An interstitial fluid is just the fluid that is between cells everywhere else in your body except blood. Right, so there is fluid between muscle fibers. There's fluid between fibroblasts that make up connective tissue. There's water surrounding all of these different cells in your body, but that's okay. That's a great thing because that fluid allows for molecules to move through that fluid from one part of your body to another to bring nutrients to these cells or to wash away harmful toxic compounds. And the reason why we have water in the interstitial space or interstitial fluid is because there is a gel-like material that is separating the cells. And from anatomy, you realize that in a connective tissue, the space between cells is what we call the matrix. Okay, and a matrix has two main components. It's got fibers. What's your favorite fiber in the matrix? Well, collagen probably is pretty good because it doesn't stretch, it holds your body together, but maybe my favorite is elastic. Because what about elastic? It stretches a little bit, and then when you let go, what happens? Yeah, you go back to the way you were, right? That would be really nice. So you got fibers, and there's another kind of fiber called reticular fibers, which are almost worthless. But The other component besides fibers is what? Something we call ground substance. And ground substance is a gel-like material. And what do you, if you're going to make Jell-O at home and you got a package of Jell-O, which is gelatin, how do you make Jell-O out of just a dry powdered gelatin? What do you add to it? Water, just a little bit, a couple drops, or what? A lot of water, right? So there's a lot of water that this ground substance can contain. Okay, and that's really good for diffusion. So here is the extracellular matrix right here. It's got more than just ground substance, but it's got fibers like collagen fibers, and it's got elastic fibers in there, and these elastic fibers can attach themselves to the, and collagen can attach themselves to proteins within a cell membrane, kind of holding all of these cells in position, but it also locks it in the correct position with regard to the matrix right here. And those proteins within the cell membrane sometimes are called integrins. So these are just like meshworks of different kinds of proteins or modified proteins, modified by putting a little sugar molecule on them to stabilize this environment, give it a little bit structure, but also allow water to dissolve in the ground substance. All right, so a glycoprotein is what? A protein that's been modified by adding a sugar molecule to it. And the same thing for a proteoglycan right over here. This is just a protein that's been modified by adding some kind of simple or disaccharide to it, right? And these are all polar compounds, so they like to exist in water and can also hold water in the interstitial place. So here you see cells, right? So this is the intracellular compartment where we see water, and the extracellular compartment is in, what, the matrix right here, but don't forget also within the plasma of blood. And I see some cells. Oh, I see some cells in this little connective tissue. What do these cells remind you of? What would be a name for these cells? Not labeled on this slide, but just because knowing anatomy is fun, you should probably remember the names of these cells right here. Anybody remember what these are called? They're secreting, yeah, you could have mast cells in here, but they're secreting these fibers, the elastic fibers and collagen fibers into the matrix. So these are fibroblasts. I think that's why they have them drawn in there. Okay, and here you see some nice red blood cells. That's the cellular compartment of blood. All right, let's talk about some transport processes across the cell membrane. We talked about membranes last time. What the heck is a membrane? You should know something about a molecule that makes it up, but also something about the nature of a membrane. What's a nice, simple way of talking about a membrane? Like in terms of how many layers does it have? It's a bilayer, right? It's got two main layers. And what is the name of the molecule that makes up those layers? Phospholipids, right? So a nice simple understanding of a cell membrane is a phospholipid bilayer. The polar head groups are on the outside, right? And the nonpolar tails are facing the inside of the membrane, so two major regions of a membrane. Okay, so think of that. But there's maybe even a better way to think of a membrane than just a phospholipid bilayer, because they never really exist like that in nature or in your cells. They have proteins embedded in the membrane, proteins doing all kinds of different things. They could be channels, they could be antigens, it could be enzymes, it could be receptors. I think we'll talk about that in one of the upcoming chapters. Okay, so plasma membrane, we say, is selectively permeable. And it's selectively permeable because it will allow some molecules to pass through, but not all kinds. And a good way to think of which ones can get through and which can't would be one by the size of the molecule, but even more importantly, just by its basic nature. Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Okay. And the ones that don't like the molecules that don't like water, which means what? The hydrophobic molecules can pass through the membrane because it can slip past those little fatty acids that are on the inside of it. It's not a barrier to molecules that are nonpolar. But, for instance, if it is a polar molecule, it can't get through that fatty internal region of a membrane, and so it's going to be stuck on one side of the membrane or the other. So that's what we call a selectively permeable or a semi-permeable membrane. It will allow some things through, but not everything. All right, so there are many important kinds of molecules that your body or the cell wants to get across the membrane, but if they're polar, right, if they dissolve in water, they can't get through by themselves, so they need to have transporters or maybe channels. And some transporters are what we call carrier-mediated transport. It involves a specific protein that allows that molecule to move through the membrane. So what kind of model of a membrane will you use to think of carrier-mediated transport on a membrane. You want to just use the phospholipid bilayer because there's no protein in the membrane. What's the best way to think of a membrane? Model in your mind. It's called the fluid mosaic model. The fluid part, the phospholipid bilayer, is very fluid, but other things are added to it, and that makes up the mosaic nature of that membrane so that it can, you're changing the structure of that membrane. What does that mean? You're changing the function of the membrane when you change its function by adding or subtracting proteins from it. Okay, non-carrier mediated transport occurs with diffusion through membrane channels. So even polar compounds can get through the membrane if there's a channel, which is a space from the outside across the membrane to the inside of the cell, as long as the molecule is small enough to fit in that channel. If the channel is real narrow, then only really small molecules can get through. Okay. All right, so when we think of transport across a membrane, there are two basic kinds in terms of thermodynamics, in terms of the energy that's required to get these molecules across. One is passive transport and the other is active transport. And I think everybody kind of has an intuitive sense, right? If it's passive transport, does that cost you anything? No. If it's active transport, that costs you something, right, in terms of energy currency. What's the energy currency molecule in your body? ATP. That's going to be one of the most important, right? But there's something else. A concentration gradient can also be used to transport molecules. All right, so for instance, if we have a bunch of water in the back row, which is way above my head, and we pour it out of the glass, where's that water going to go? Down the gradient in this room, right? It's going to go from high to low. Okay, when it does, it can bring other kinds of things with it. All right, here is a definition that you should be familiar with. Without this definition, I don't think you'll understand anything that's going on in this chapter. Probably all of you are familiar with it, but it's so important. Let's just go over it really quickly. All right, what the heck is a solution? It's a mixture of something, right? It's a mixture of different kinds of things. But in general, what are the components that make up a solution? There's something that we call a solvent, right? And then there's something we call a solute. And the solvent is just the majority molecule. What is this solution mostly made out of? And in most cases, right, we're either going to be talking about a gas or a liquid, but in our case, we're going to be talking about liquids. All right, and what is the solvent in our bodies that makes us very liquid? It is water, right? And other kinds of chemistry, that's not always going to be the case. But for biology, that is the case. And a solute is what? It's a lesser amount of material, lesser amount of junk that's dissolved in the solvent, right? So solute are the particular kinds of things, and they're just little particles. We think of it because you have so much solvent that the solutes are a very minor component of the solution. All right, but you've probably made a solution today. What solution did you make? Maybe, and even if you didn't go to lab, what solution did you make? Coffee, for instance. All right, what was the solvent that you used? Water, pretty tricky, but that's a good place to start. Okay, I was just being facetious. Not tricky at all, right? Water is very common. And what's the solute that you made coffee with? Sugar, maybe some cream, those are minor components. Water is the major component, but also the little compounds that make coffee up, right? But those would all be solutes. All right, so in your body, what's a major solvent in your body? That's water, but you have another solvent in your body as well. It's a minor solvent, but people are beginning to realize it's very important. Water doesn't like to dissolve in it, so it's not a polar solvent, it's a nonpolar solvent. All right, and the minor solvent in your body is actually lipids, okay? And there are certain things that can dissolve in lipids. There are some fat-soluble vitamins, right? There are even, where's another place inside your body where it's just instead of a water world, it's a lipid world, but it's a really small lipid world. It's the inside of every membrane. The interior of every membrane is that lipid world, and there are things that are going really inside that membrane, okay, that are going to be really important later on in the class. So that's the minor solvent. And, of course, you saw that things don't like to go from one environment to the other based on their nature. Okay, so let's talk about transport processes again. First, diffusion. Diffusion, you got to first characterize as being active or passive. And I'll just say that it's a passive process, right? Which means what? It happens all by itself. Right, so it's a really nice thing. This is one way for your body to move molecules around. Does not cost any kind of energy. happens automatically, but it is what we call the net movement of a substance from a region of high concentration to low concentration. So let's just figure that we have a beaker right here, and we have a high concentration of something over here and a low concentration over there. It means the net movement is that some of the molecules in the low concentration will move to high a little bit, okay, but by far, most of them go from high concentration to low. So if we subtract these two rates of motion, then what's going to win out? Going from right to left, always from high concentration to low. All right, and this process will stop, all right? For instance, let's consider this another little thought experiment. Maybe I've got a perfume bottle in my hand right here, and there's no perfume in the room. So where's the concentration of perfume the highest? Right here in the bottle. I open up the cap, it starts to evaporate into the air, so now you have a little bit higher concentration of perfume in the air right around the bottle. Okay, and what's the concentration in the back row? It's going to be zero, basically, which is low. All right, so because of diffusion, that molecule will move from high concentration to low. Who's going to smell it first, back row or first row? First row, then the second row, then the third row. Right, and if we leave that perfume bottle open all night long, come into the class, right, and we walk in the bottom door over here and then leave, and then walk in that door over there and then leave, and then go in the doors at the top, all right, what is that perfume going to smell like? Is the intensity going to be the same, irregardless of what door you walk in, or is it going to smell stronger down here compared to up there? Okay, after a long period of time, diffusion is going to even out the mixture within the room. Even though we don't have a fan in here blowing the perfume around, it's going to be the same concentration in the back and in the front. And then furthermore, this is the point I really want to get to, when the perfume concentration is the same in the back of the room compared to the front, how much perfume is moving from the front to the back compared to from the back to the front? The same motion. So what can you say about diffusion then when the concentration gradient disappears? There's no net diffusion. These molecules are still moving around, but nothing is changing. The concentration is going to be uniform within the whole room if you wait a long period of time. Maybe overnight would be sufficient. All right, so when the concentration gradient disappears, there's no net diffusion. So what you can think of this as, like, what is the energy that is making diffusion happen? It's the concentration gradient. And concentration gradient, I mean that there's got to be a difference in concentration in two different locations, right? So even though it's passive, there has to be a concentration gradient in order to get diffusion to work. All right. Who's really familiar with that concept, or who wants maybe one, does anybody want one more example of passive and active transport? Maybe I see a couple people looking at me. Let's take this hill right here. Come on, marker. Here we have a hill. And let's consider the car I had when I was in college. It was a really nice car. All right? It was maybe a little bit longer than that, but not much longer. It was an MGB, 1968 MGB. Really small car, only fit two people. But unfortunately, with that car, sometimes the starter motor wouldn't work, sometimes the battery was dead, all kinds of little problems, right? So I get done at school or work, I hop in my car, and I turn the key, and I would hear click, 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 click. Okay, so what does that mean? Can't go home. What a hassle, right? So where would I always park my car? Because I never knew if it would start by turning the key. I'd park it on top of a hill, okay? Because I knew that, and it was just a really tiny car, I could stick my left foot out the door with my big toe, just give it a little push, and what would happen to my car? Okay, it would start going down the hill, and going down the hill, do I have to have the gas engine on? No, because it wants to go from high to low, no problem, right? That's a passive process. And as I got some energy working, right, I could pop the clutch and start the engine, and I could drive home, thank goodness. Okay, and I always had pretty good brakes on that car. And then once I got home, I could stop, which is another important thing. All right, so going from high to low is what we call what, active or passive? That's a passive process. All right, but let's just say my home was up over here high and I happened to park my car down over here. All right, how would I go from low to high? Going this way. What has to happen? That's an active process. And in you, how do you fuel most active processes? ATP, right? So my car needed gasoline, but you guys mostly need ATP. All right, so don't forget, going from high to low is passive, from low to high. High to low is passive, going from low to high. It still sounds weird. Am I saying that right? From high to low is passive, but going from low to high is an active process requiring energy. All right, so, and diffusion is what kind of mechanism? Diffusion is what? High concentration to low concentration. It's a passive process. Here's a pretty good example of diffusion right here. Remember, nonpolar compounds can readily diffuse through the cell membrane, can get through that phospholipid bilayer. I'd still recommend a 1968 MGB, but it didn't have airbags. It's always good to have airbags in a car. Okay. Nonpolar. Why can nonpolar compounds diffuse through a cell membrane? Because they can because they're compatible with the fatty acids, right, of the phospholipid. Yeah, question. Oh yeah, we got to make one up. I forgot. I wasn't even thinking about the sign-in sheet before lab, but that's important. If somebody's got a blank piece of paper, do you have a blank piece of paper again? Thank you. Yeah, because I want to know if you guys are here. Because believe it or not, it helps coming to a lecture. Doesn't seem like it. But if you miss a lecture and then come the day after, it just doesn't feel good. I know it doesn't feel good when that happens. Okay. All right, also some small molecules such as CO2 and water. In some cells, water can go across the cell membrane, but not all of them. All right, but gas, for instance, oxygen and CO2 can move through the cell membrane just fine. And that's how your cells can utilize oxygen, okay, and get rid of CO2. CO2 is a waste product. All right, so oxygen is going to enter tissues or cells of your body, and so it happens by diffusion. Where is there a high concentration of oxygen? Inside the cell or in the air that we're breathing? In the air, okay? And true, you got to have a high oxygen concentration in your cells to stay alive, but that's got to be lower than the air, otherwise oxygen wouldn't go by diffusion from the air into the cells of your body, right? It's got to go what? From high to low, and if these are your cells down over here, it's got to be low concentration of oxygen, otherwise oxygen wouldn't move that way. What about CO2 right here? Okay, where is CO2 concentration high? Inside the cell, is that true? But CO2 is toxic. Is it true that it's the highest concentration and it's low in the air? Well, yes, you're right, because otherwise CO2 wouldn't leave your body. If CO2 was high in the air, it would be trapped inside your body, but you want to excrete it. Fortunately, the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere is almost zero, so there's a big concentration gradient. All right, so how does CO2 leave your body? In a big hurry, because the concentration gradient is what? It's big. That's the point I'm trying to make. But you're right, yeah, it does by diffusion. But remember, diffusion works by the concentration gradient. Okay. Well, now what if you can't get through this phospholipid bilayer right here? All right, we said that molecules have to have a pore. So here's a protein. So now think of the fluid mosaic model of this membrane. Here is a protein channel. Sometimes this channel can be open, like down over here, and then molecules can move. In this particular case, it's closed. So here we have we've got water, okay? But these, what are these particles? If the background color is water, what are these particles called? What makes a solution again? Solutes. So these are the solute molecules. And over here, on the extracellular side, do these solute molecules, do they want to get into the cell? But they can't. They want to get in, but they can't, right? Because they want to go down their concentration gradient. So maybe these are charged compounds, maybe like sodium or potassium, maybe even a sugar, because sugar is highly polar because all those hydroxyl groups on it. So then this channel has to open up, okay, and then cells can diffuse down the concentration gradient passively. All right, so what can you tell me about this membrane right here? Is it fully permeable or selectively permeable? It's selectively permeable. And as a matter of fact, if this is a living membrane, it can choose when to open up these channels and when to close them. All right, so that's pretty amazing. We'll look and see how that happens. All right, so that's still diffusion. So you can write out an equation for diffusion, and maybe you do that in lab. And you want to think of the rate. How fast does diffusion take place? Well, there's some things that speed diffusion up, and there's things that slow it down, right? So if you have an equation, And if it speeds the rate of diffusion up, it's going to be directly related to it. So if one side of the equation increases quantitatively, what happens to the left side? It increases as well. We call that directly related. So what are some parameters that are directly related to diffusion? The concentration gradient, right? As the concentration gradient increases, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It increases. And as the concentration approaches zero, what happens to diffusion? It approaches zero as well. And indeed, if the concentration gradient is zero, then there is no diffusion, right? Okay. Permeability of the membrane also is directly related. The more channels or pores you have in the membrane, the faster things can go through a membrane, right? Temperature is also important. As you increase the temperature, diffusion increases, right? As something gets colder, diffusion stops. And as a matter of fact, as soon as something freezes into a solid, what happens to diffusion? Everything gets locked into position and it just stops, right? All right, so that probably tells you something about why we are homeothermic organisms. We regulate our temperature because we want diffusion to take place at a regular rate, right? We don't want to regulate diffusion in our body by adjusting temperature. That just wouldn't work. And also, as you make the membrane bigger, the surface area of the membrane, that just means that the doorway is bigger for exchange, that also increases the rate. But there is something that slows diffusion down. Say you have a big tractor trailer out on Valley View, okay, driving down the street, you're stopped at a stoplight, and you're in the truck, and a motorcycle pulls up next to you, and you're going to race through the intersection, all right? You bet this guy $1,000, you can beat him on the motorcycle. You're in this big, long truck, right, that's 50 feet long. Was that a good bet? No, the motorcycle is always going to be faster. Same thing for smaller molecules, right? So as the molecule gets bigger, the molecular weight increases. What does that mean? That slows the rate of diffusion down. So smaller molecules diffuse faster than large molecules. So that's pretty important to know. All right, here is an important concept, and that is of osmosis. And osmosis is a passive process. It works by diffusion. So in order for a molecule to move by osmosis, how does it have to go with respect to that concentration gradient? It has to do what? From one concentration to an equal concentration? From a low concentration to high concentration? Or from high concentration to low? The third choice, the very last choice. Osmosis will work from high concentration to low because we said it's what? It's passive, it's just diffusion. But it's a special case of diffusion. There have to be three criteria in order for it to be osmosis. So here we have, maybe we could think of this as something inside the cell, here's outside the cell, here's the cell membrane. All right, so here is some kind of septum that's separating this chamber into two different components, two different compartments. All right, and right now, okay, I see these big particles, and then water we can't see. So these big particles are solute. And when I look at this illustration right here, oh, I do see more solute on the right compared to the left. I see more, what are these, purple, blue, gray, red. Okay, I knew I'd get there sooner or later. Okay, these red particles, you see more red particles on the right compared to the left over here? All right, which means what? There's more water on the left compared to the right. Right, just because, well, if we think in terms of a percent, if you have a higher percentage of solute, you got a lesser percentage of solvent on the right. So let's zoom in to this area of the membrane. It's got pores, right? So it's not a solid wall. Some molecules can move through and some can't. Which ones can move through? The small ones, which we're going to say is water. So here's the more dilute side, here's the more concentrated side. In terms of solute, not in terms of solvent, but in terms of solute. This is the more concentrated side right over here. So what about these large particles? Do they want to move to the left? Yeah, because here is high concentration, here is low. They want to, but tough luck. They can't because the pores aren't big enough to let that molecule through, right? What about a water molecule? You have a lot of water on the left, not very much on the right. It wants to go from high concentration to low, but can it? Absolutely, because it can fit through the pores. So here is a membrane, all right, and we talk about this membrane as being selectively permeable in this example based on size, or you could say semi-permeable, however you want to spell it out. okay? But conceptually, it's exactly, it's the same. So this membrane right here is semi-permeable. There's something else too. This particle right here is going to be what we call osmotically active. It's osmotically active because it's going to help develop pressure on either side of this membrane right here, right? Because it can't move through the membrane. So if a particle is osmotically active, it cannot freely move across the membrane. If it can freely move across the membrane, then it is not osmotically active. All right, we're going to have to work with these concepts just a little bit more before I think you're really familiar with it. So let's start talking about it. Those little channels that allow water through a membrane, sometimes in cells we call those aquaporins. So a pore is just a hole in the membrane, and aqua means what? Water. Okay. All right, so these solute molecules can't diffuse through the membrane, but water can because it's small enough. And let's look at this situation over here. A lot more solutes, 360 grams per liter of glucose on this side. It's only 180 on the left-hand side. So you have higher concentration of water on the left. Which way is water going to move? From left to right, down its concentration gradient. What about sugar? Where is it going to move? It's going to want to move to the left, but remember, it can't because this is a selectively permeable membrane. So as water moves through these pores right here, what happens to the volume of the chamber on the right-hand side? It's got to get bigger because we're putting more molecules in there. If the pressure across this membrane is going to be the same, right? If the pressure is the same, right, then the chamber on the right-hand side has to get bigger. And when is this membrane going to stop moving? When there's no concentration gradient anymore, right? When you have the same concentration of solute and solvent across it, it's going to stop moving. But what happened to the size? Let's just say this is a cell right here, and water moved into it. What happened to the size of that cell? It got bigger, right? Yes, it did. And maybe this membrane is strong enough and elastic enough to do that, but in a lot of cases, the cell membrane isn't. What's going to happen to the cell if this were a cell and it starts to expand? At some point in time, it might actually blow up, right? It will expand, and we call that lysis. That happens. Do you want that for your cells? No, you don't. You don't want it for any of your patients either. So we're going to be really concerned about that. All right, so when you have an unequal concentration of water across the membrane and have osmotically active solutes, which means they can't get through the membrane, osmotic pressure is developed, right, which is going to change the size of this compartment over here, and let's just say this is intracellular. All right, so water is going to diffuse in. Osmotic pressure is the amount of pressure that you have to push up against this wall or cell membrane to prevent a change in shape. That's the osmotic pressure. And that's going to be equally and opposite to what? The direction of water on the inside pushing the cell out. That is osmotic pressure. Right? And then it's proportional to solute concentration. If the solute concentration is the same, there is no osmotic pressure. Right? But if there is a gradient, that produces osmotic pressure right there. All right, let's get into some chemistry kinds of concepts before we really consider some living world osmotic pressure conditions. Here we have a scale, two cases. We've got A and B, and we have a scale. And on this scale, we're putting glucose. How much glucose are we putting on scale 1 and scale 2? Exactly the same amount, right? Just 180 grams of glucose we put here and here, exactly the same. And then we're going to put that in this little bottle. This is an Erlenmeyer flask, right? And you can see it's the same Erlenmeyer flask. We're not changing anything. Right at this level, if we were to fill this flask up with any kind of fluid or even a solute to this level right here, right, it's going to be exactly how much? That's the 1 liter mark. That's going to be 1 liter of stuff that we put in this flask. Okay. Well, there are two ways that we can add substance to this flask. The first is when we make a molar solution of something. Right? We take 1 mole of solute, okay, which for glucose is 180 grams, and I think you have some quantitative exercises at the end of this chapter to figure that out using a periodic table. Okay, and 1 mole of something is equal to this many particles, right? 6. times 10 to the 23rd. Is that a big number or a little number? That's huge, right? If you had that many dollars, you could buy me lunch for the rest of your life and a house and a car, and it wouldn't matter. You wouldn't care. Okay, that's a huge number. So that's just how many molecules that are in a mole of something. And if you take this many molecules of glucose, 180 grams is what it would weigh. Okay? And so we take 180 grams, and we put it in this Erlenmeyer flask, and that's to make a molar solution. Right? Then we want to pour water in until we get exactly to the 1 liter mark. So how much water did we pour into the flask? Was it 1 liter, more than a liter, or less than a liter? Okay. Well, don't forget, what did we put in this flask first? We put in glucose first. That has some volume, right? That took up some space. So we can't put exactly 1 liter in because then we would go over this line. So we just add water until it gets what? Reaches this line. So it's going to be less than a liter. Right? That's how you would mix up a molar solution. Right? So it doesn't really specify how much water you put in there. You just fill it up to this line, what, before or after you put the glucose in? Okay? Yeah, after you put the glucose in there, right? Okay. Another way to make up a solution, then don't forget what a solution is, it's what? Solute and solvent together. And we make a molal solution, spelled a little bit differently. Hopefully you can understand my pronunciation of it. How do you make a molal solution of something? You still have to take 1 mole of glucose, which is how heavy? 180 grams, put it in this Erlenmeyer flask, and now take exactly 1 liter of water and pour it on top. So now you have exactly 1 liter of water plus a bunch of other junk, that glucose. What's going to be the total volume? It's not going to be 1 liter. It's going to be 1 liter plus the glucose that you put in, and you can see now what's the level of the solution. It's above the 1 liter mark right here. And it just so happens that that's how a kilogram was defined. If you take a liter of water, it weighs exactly 1 kilogram. So now you have something a little bit more in volume than 1 liter. That's a molal solution. So a couple different ways of mixing solutions up. Molarity versus molality. All right, there's another consideration, because some molecules like glucose, okay, when we put them in solution, water, they don't break apart. Other substances that you know, that when we put them in water, they're formed by ionic bonds, and ionic bonds are what, strong or weak? They're relatively weak, so those ionic bonds can break, and now you have twice the number of particles if, for instance, it's sodium chloride, because you put sodium chloride in water, it's going to break apart into 2 particles. If you put glucose in water, it does not break apart. That's going to determine the osmotic properties of this solution, okay, or of these 2 solutions. So, if we put a 1 molal solution of glucose over here on the left and a 1 molal solution of NaCl on the right, what's going to happen to this sodium chloride molecule, NaCl? It's going to dissociate, it's going to break apart. And now what do you have? Twice as many particles over here, even though we started with the same molal solution. You got twice as many particles, which means what about the concentration of water over here? It's going to be half, because now you have twice as many particles. All right, so on the left-hand side, you got a 1 osmolar solution over here. You got a 2 osmolar solution. All right, so there's whenever you see that osmolar, that OS at the beginning, you have to take into account dissociation. And that's going to then change the osmotic properties of these 2 components. So now we have high water concentration on the left, we got low on the right because we got twice as many particles over here, so water is going to want to go from high concentration to low. When it does, the osmotic pressure increases, and again, it's going to force this cell to expand when that happens. Okay, and again, that's why we're very concerned about maintaining the normal shape of cells. We got to consider what the normal of particles within solution. So when this happens, we end up with a 1.5 molal solution of glucose over here, but a 0.75 molal solution of sodium chloride on the other side because it's been diluted. But what about the osmolar solutions? They're exactly the same, and when they're exactly the same, what happens to diffusion? It stops, right? So now you have the same numbers of particles of water and the same particles of solute on both sides of this membrane, and osmosis is going to stop, okay? Or in this particular case, diffusion. Okay, let's look at, let me draw some figures on the board. Let's talk about something really interesting, like some living cells that you have in your body, okay? And Let's talk about some red blood cells. So here we have a beaker with some red blood cells in it. The color is not significant. Here is another marker. Let's try some of these down over here. Maybe these are even darker still. All right, so here we have, okay, a beaker in blue and red and all kinds of different kinds of colors. Okay, and here is another beaker. I want this up a little bit so I don't have to face you when I talk. Okay, maybe like that. Here is a second beaker. And, better yet, here is a third beaker. And here is a nice red blood cell. And this red blood cell has got a 0.9, as a matter of fact. Pretty much all cells in your body have a concentration of about 0.9% solute, but I'm just going to put NaCl. All right, this means solute. Those are the particles that are inside that cell. All right, so how much water is inside the cell? It would be 100% minus the amount of solute, which is what? 99.1% H2O, which means what? A lot of water, okay? So let's put another red blood cell over here. Same thing, 0.9% NaCl. How much water? 99.1% H2O. And we can even put the same cell over here. Here's a nice red blood cell, 0.9% NaCl, and then 99.1, but H2O. Okay, pretty good. So let's put this cell right here in distilled water. What's the percentage of water in distilled water? Let's just say, it might not be absolutely pure, but let's pretend it's absolutely pure. So distilled water right here, 100% water. All right, nice pure water. Spent a lot of time getting that. And we said for this particular kind of cell, water can move through the membrane, but this sodium chloride can't. It's too big. Maybe it's too charged or something. So what kind of membrane is that? That's selectively permeable. Now, water can move through. Is water going to move through that membrane? Is there going to be net diffusion of water across that membrane right there? Yeah. Because the concentration of water is different. There is a concentration gradient. Furthermore, you got to know which way it goes. Which way is it going to go? High to low. What's higher, 100% or 99.1? 100%. Is that a lot higher or just a little bit higher? It's a little bit higher, but you know what? In terms of the cell, it's a huge difference. So small changes in concentration gradient mean big changes. So water moves in. What happens to the size of the cell right here? It gets bigger and bigger, and as a matter of fact, it changes so fast that the cell blows up. It gets destroyed. Okay, so if you want to transfuse somebody, you want to transfuse pure water. What would you do to the cells in their body? Well, you'd blow them up. That's not good. Okay, you don't ever want to blow anybody up, right? So that's why we're going through this discussion right here. So you got to know the name of this solution right here. Okay, and what happens to the cell? We call the cell, when it gets blown up like that, hemolysis. All right, so because we're talking about blood, hemolysis and lysis is what? Just exploding a cell. The kind of solution this is right here is what we call a hypotonic solution. All right, so a good question would be, what happens to the cell when it's placed in a hypotonic solution? It bursts. It lyses. Okay, so you should kind of know the mechanism of this thing right here.
Wouldn't it be hyper because it's greater
outside the cell? Yeah, but it's the pressure inside the cell compared to the outside.
Yeah.
It's a little weird. I think a good thing to do is just kind of memorize that. All right, so if we put this red blood cell in what we call just a normal tonic salt solution, okay, and that's going to have 0.9% salt in the solution, how much water is going to be in the solution? 99.1% water, okay. Which way is water going to move? Is it higher on the inside or outside? It's going to be the same, right? So what's going to happen to the shape of this cell right here? It's going to stay the same, which is what we want to do for health. This is what we call an isotonic solution. So an isotonic solution, because you have the concentration of water and solutes just in the right mixture, preserves the shape of this cell, right? And since we're not changing the shape, what are we doing to the function? It's going to still going to remain healthy, right? It's a nice, healthy cell. And in this particular case over here, let's put this in seawater or some kind of high salt concentration, because I can't remember what the salt concentration is for seawater. But let's just say it is 2.5% NaCl. Not a drastic change, 2.5%. How much water is here? About 97.5% water. Okay, now is water going to move across the membrane? Yeah, and it's going to go from what, high to low? What's higher, 97 or 99? 99 is higher, so water is going to move out. What's going to happen to the cell right here? It's going to shrink. The proper name for that is crenation, right? Crenation, or it's going to crenate, crenation, okay? And then you have to know what kind of solution causes crenation. And that is a hypertonic. I haven't thought about this all summer long. How can I remember that? You can memorize it. Maybe you can have, like, photographic memory. Yeah.
Okay, I have another question.
Okay.
Because you're referring to the solution now.
Okay, yeah. We just call that a hypertonic solution. Mostly because we think about the example that I used in class, how much pressure do we have to push on the membrane to get it back where it was to resist the pressure changes? Let's go back to this slide right here. Where did it go? Right here. How much do we have to push back to get the membrane back where it was? So it's kind of an opposite concept. It's just an opposite concept. But that opposite concept you don't have to appreciate. It's not like pH where you have to know which way it's going. Okay. But this you do have to know. Hypertonic is going to crenate the cell. And what does crenation look like? The cell is going to get all spiky, right, appearance. You might look at some cells in lab, and it's smaller because water has left it. Okay. All right, so I can tell you a really dumb way of memorizing this. As long as you don't tell anybody ever in your professional life that you learned this from me, okay? Okay, because here is an O in hypotonic. Here is an O in hemolysis. Here is an E in hypertonic. Here is an E in crenation. Now, some of you will think that's so dumb that you can't even remember it, and that's maybe true. If that's the case, you should know the mechanism anyway, right? Which way water molecule is moving. Okay, one of these processes is irreversible, and the other is reversible. Which process is irreversible? Yeah, when you put it in a hypotonic solution causing hemolysis. All right, but if we take these cells that are crenated and we put them back in an isotonic solution, what happens to them? They go back to their normal shape. So when somebody's dehydrated, right, and their cells are all shrinking, what's the best thing to do? Okay, hydrate them, not with a hypotonic solution because you might start blowing some cells up, but rehydrate them with an isotonic solution. And that's, who's really most susceptible to that? Kind of, yeah, children, little babies. So what do you give a little baby to drink even? Like Pedialyte, right? Something that has the right mixture of, and even if you're exercising, that's probably not a bad thing to do, right? When you're low on fluids, water is fine, but probably an isotonic solution would even be better for you. It doesn't disrupt your electrolyte balance and water balance inside your body. All right, so just kind of make sure that you can draw that out and appreciate which way things go. So tonicity, isotonic solutions, right, have the same osmotic pressure across the membrane. The cell doesn't shrink. Hypotonic solutions have higher osmotic pressure and are osmotically active. Hypotonic have lower osmotic pressure, and therefore the cells explode. And here's a good example, isotonic, hypotonic solution. Eventually the cell is going to explode, and hypertonic, these cells are crenated. All right, now do these processes qualify for osmosis? Let's talk about osmosis, getting back to osmosis. What are the three criteria? Okay, we're talking about diffusion, Which means what? A molecule is going to go from high concentration to low. So number one, osmosis has to be diffusion. Something goes from high to low. And it's only one kind of molecule. And it's got to be the solvent molecule. Okay? And in us, what's the solvent molecule? So you could say water, but that's not always going to be the case if you deal in chemistry with other kinds of solutions. It's going to be the solvent molecule. So what about so far? Is this osmosis? It's moving from high to low, and what molecule are we talking about? The solvent molecule. The third criteria is that the membrane, there's got to be a membrane, right? It's just not a pure solution with no membrane. It's got to be a membrane, but it's got to be a very special membrane. It's got to be selectively permeable. Right, and is this a selectively permeable membrane? Yeah, because that sodium chloride can't get out. That's why this is what we call an osmotically active molecule, because it's gonna develop the osmotic pressure because this membrane is selectively permeable. So do these processes qualify for osmosis? Yeah, because it's the water molecule, selectively permeable membrane, and it's only moving down a concentration gradient. All right, so a little bit of physiology, not so much physical chemistry right now. Excuse me. Okay, regulation of blood osmolality. So you can conceive that that's a very important process in your body because you want your cells to stay the same shape, right? You don't want them to change. But here's a weird question before we get to this slide right here. Can you overdose on water? Absolutely, right? It's a really horrific thing when that happens. Even though you need water in your body, you certainly can. And when you drink too much water, what's going to happen? Okay, yeah, you're going to die. So here you're drinking this hypotonic solution. Where does that water end up? It goes into your blood. Your cells in your blood swell up, okay? But then water diffuses everywhere through the ground substance that makes you up, including your brain. What happens to the size of your brain? It starts to swell up. But can it really swell up? What's holding it? You got a really big, your brain is in a really big hard container. Your cranium can't expand, right? Those bones, the cranial bones. What's a good cranial bone? What's your favorite cranial bone? Cranial bone? How about frontal bone? Okay, well, you got a bunch of bones that make up the cranial vault. You might want to think of those, which ones those are. All right, your occipital bone. Okay, that's really good. As a matter of fact, let's talk about that one, occipital bone. So since the cranial vault can't expand, but the cells of your brain are expanding, guess what happens? Well, your brain gets forced out of your cranium, out through the foramen magnum, which is in what bone? Yeah, the occipital bone, right? So that's a really difficult process to stop, reverse. So that happened not too long ago. There was a contest. Whoever could drink the most water would win a pickup truck. And somebody really had their heart set on the pickup truck, and they didn't get to the hospital in time, even though there were medical professionals there saying, hey, you know, you need treatment, but the person expired as a result of that. So certainly you can overdose with water because the following mechanism can't act fast enough, okay, to preserve the shape of cells inside your body. All right, so here is a response loop, right, and you all should just fall back on that picture that you had to draw in lab of what a response loop is. What does a response loop always start with? Stimulus. Here's the stimulus, dehydration. All right, so when you're dehydrated, what happens to your blood volume? Well, yeah, it goes down, right? So blood volume starts to go down. And what happens to plasma? Does it become more salty or less salty? More salty, which means an increase in plasma osmolality. All right, so that's your blood. And where does blood go? Everywhere in your body, including your brain. And what do you have in your brain that can measure osmolality? Right, the part is the hypothalamus. Right, there are receptors there called osmoreceptors, and it can sense, right? The hypothalamus then is the integration center. It can then compare this osmolality to a set point, and it says, aha, there's an error. So it makes a decision. So all that happens in what? The integration center. Integration center can make a decision. There are some efferent pathways right here, which we won't get into that necessarily right now. The hypothalamus then causes ADH secretion from the posterior pituitary. We just basically touched on that just a little bit in anatomy. We'll get into it a little bit more detail. ADH stands for antidiuretic hormone. What does a diuretic make you do? Makes you pee. What does an antidiuretic do? and that helps you retain water, right? It cuts back on urine production, right? So that antidiuretic hormone goes to the kidneys, right? And it increases water retention. All right, let's look at the other part of this diagram. The hypothalamus then also sends impulses to your consciousness, giving you the sensation that you're thirsty. And then when you're thirsty, under most normal circumstances, you drink water. Okay, so drink. That increases water intake. At the same time, you're retaining more water in your body. What happens to blood volume when that happens? It increases. What happens to plasma saltiness or osmolality? It goes back down. So this feeds back to the stimulus, and does it add or subtract to it? It subtracts from the stimulus. What kind of feedback loop subtracts from the stimulus? Where the response subtracts from the stimulus. That is a nice negative feedback mechanism, right? And negative feedback is what? A good or bad kind of feedback? Good, because it maintains what? Homeostasis, right? Okay. All right, so that's the importance of some of these concepts and why we're dealing with them. Okay, carrier-mediated transport. Some molecules are too large, maybe too polar, to diffuse across the membrane. They need carriers. We haven't talked about carriers yet. We're just talking about what component of the cell membrane that allows water to go through it. Because water is polar. It doesn't necessarily like to go across the cell membrane. It has aquaporins, just little channels. Okay, so let's talk about a different kind of transport across the cell membrane for polar molecules that otherwise wouldn't go across. Maybe it wants to, but it can't make it through. All right? So carrier-mediated transport. Molecules must bind to that membrane protein before they can be transported. All right? So let's take a look at some examples, how we classify membrane transport. Here is a graph. And it's always good to be able to read graphs in here to interpret data. And you always want to compare what the axes of a graph are. So we're plotting, right, the rate of transport of some kind of molecule. Let's call it X molecule, okay? X molecule. And the rate of transport of that molecule is going to change depending on its concentration. As we change the concentration, and usually we put little arrows at the ends of these graphs right here so we know it's getting bigger as you go from left to right or from bottom to top, okay? What happens to the rate of transport as the concentration of Mr. X increases? As we look at these lines right here, the rate of transport increases. Thanks so much. Okay, so don't forget, if you walked in late, you're bad. But sign the sign-in sheet anyway, okay, please. All right, so as the rate of X, as the concentration of X increases, right, what can you tell me about diffusion, for instance, as the concentration gradient increases? Is directly related, so it increases as well. All right, so in this particular case, right, carrier-mediated transport is, well, let's just consider it a passive process. Then the rate of transport across the membrane increases, but you see, as we reach a point when if the concentration still increases, what happens to the rate? It levels off. And when it levels off, it doesn't really stop, but the rate stops increasing, right? We call that saturation. Because what has to happen before X can go across the membrane? It's got to bind to that carrier protein, right? And when the carrier protein is bound to X, it can't bind another one at exactly the same time. So that transport mechanism gets filled up, all right? Now, if you want to continue, if a cell wants to continue to increase the rate of transport of X past this point, so it's leveling off, what has to happen to the membrane? You have to add more protein carriers to it. And if you add more protein carriers, then of course the rate of transport will increase. Okay, cells do this all the time. So one important point about mediated transport is this concept of saturation. All right, so saturation is an important concept. When all carriers are occupied, right, we call that the transport maximum. Okay, another important concept is that in order for X to bind to the carrier molecule, right, it has to have the right shape. It's got to have the right shape. If it's the wrong shape, it can't bind to the carrier molecule. If it can't bind, it can't get across the membrane. All right, so if you change the shape of either the carrier or the solute, what happens to the physiology? It changes drastically, right? Can't get through the cell membrane. It's stuck on one side or the other. And carrier-mediated transport, along with many other kinds of binding phenomena inside your body, are highly specific, which means that the shapes of these compounds have to match up. All right, so if you're going to take your hand and put it in a glove that has two fingers, is it going to fit inside the glove? It's not going to fit inside the glove, right? It's got to be, the shapes have to be complementary to each other. And just like when we look at that nucleotide, RNA nucleotides versus DNA nucleotides, a small change in shape means what? A huge change in how the physiology transpires, right? Same thing for transport across membranes. All right, the last concept right here is that if you have a glucose molecule that has a certain shape, has six carbon atoms, and a fructose which has six carbon atoms, right? Maybe that fructose can bind to the transporter as well because it has almost exactly the right kind of shape. All right, so if you have fructose as well as sucrose in solution, both molecules X and Y, what happens to the transport of which compound? It's just X, even though there's another molecule in there that has a similar kind of shape. If it has a similar kind of shape, it reduces the transport maximum of the molecule that we're considering the transport of. All right, and we call that competition. So these are three important characteristics that characterize a carrier-mediated transport mechanism. Specificity, which means what? The molecules have to be complementary in shape to the receptor. All right? There could be competition with that transporter if there is another molecule that has almost the right kind of shape. And once those carrier proteins are completely occupied with the molecule that's being transported, no further rate of increase is possible. We call that saturation. So we got specificity, competition, and saturation. All right, so that's going to be important. So next time, I think we're going to start right here with facilitated diffusion. Wow, and I talked way too long on this. But you got to read ahead. But that's okay, because we got class on Thursday. But don't... And Tuesday next week, too. Okay, because you guys don't have a holiday.